The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Annual sponsor is the Idaho Humanities Council. Annual sponsor is the Idaho Humanities Council. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Mark Wheeler.
In 1939, in New York City, at the World's Fair, the Swedish delegation introduced for the first time this notion of a smorgasbord. And I am delighted today because I think we have a smorgasbord today of culinary knowledge and insight. And I imagine that most of you are like me and that you have an interest in this part of our lives. And so it's really a joy for us to welcome today Guy Hand. Guy is probably known to most of you, longtime food journalist, managing editor of Edible Idaho. Immediately to Guy's left is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is the chef and owner of Petite Four and formerly of Bluebird Cafe. Next to Sarah, Chris Komori. Chris is the former State and Lemp chef and co-owner. Chris is also a Beard nominee, and there's rumor that there's this really fun thing coming down the pike here in the future. We're excited about that. And then finally, at the end of the table, Dave Crick. Dave is owner of Bitter Creek Ale House, Red Feather Lounge, and his newest endeavor, Diablo & Sons Saloon. So will you take just a moment and welcome our panelists today? To get us started here today, I want to ask a quick question. I am curious of our panelists, when I use the word food, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Guy?
Culture.
Work.
Yep, probably work for me.
For me, it's family.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy.
Let me another sort of a softball question to get started. If you're just hanging out and you decide you're going to run out for a quick bite to eat in Boise, what's a favorite spot you go to these days and why? Anyone? Guy?
Petite Four and Bitter Creek.
That's good secret.
Fair enough. Sarah?
I like going, I don't go out to eat that much, but I would say Madoban. I like going out for food that I'm not going to cook myself, and those guys do a much better job than me at cooking Indian food or ethnic foods.
So. Recently, I have a three-year-old now, so it's kind of whatever he chooses. He loves noodles, so we actually get a lot of pho, so we go to Filet quite often.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
We find ourselves at Flatbread for the make-yourself pizza for our eight-year-old quite often. If it's just Jamie and I, it's usually, you know, Bargernica, or it used to be Bluebird.
Yeah, we've got
it used to be Bluebird, and we like to go to Petite Four, but we can never get in.
We're in a unique space, I think, in the history of our city. As Guy sort of alluded to in a conversation we've had in the past, you know, 10 years ago, we were seeing restaurants close and really the restaurant scene kind of stagnant, if not deteriorating. Clearly, that's not the case today, as we see this revitalization that has happened, and it's happening not only in Boise, but across the valley. We're seeing the food scene and food culture develop. As we think about food culture, so we're talking really about the spectrum between those folks who produce the products and the end product that gets served to us in the table. What are some of the unique challenges you see facing restaurateurs and the restaurant industry today? Chris, let me start with you.
There are a lot of them specific to the Valley. I know that across the board, when you talk to restaurateurs and chefs, labor talent pool in general is a big issue. Retention of that, not only within your own establishment, but within the city. And then sourcing is a big issue as well. There are a lot of great farms, small farms that are coming up, There's challenges of how to consistently work with them and to develop together. Just as easy as the communication and delivery seems like it is, it's very difficult. There's not necessarily an organization that is really getting it all put together. So I know Sarah was mentioning earlier, it's difficult for us to go to a farm, spend an hour of your day when we're in a kitchen for 12 hours a day. You know, that extra hour means a lot. And sometimes it can be the difference of being able to support those local farms. So the infrastructure of that is an issue as well.
Dave?
Yeah, restaurants are a tough business. It's a lifestyle business. And for people who survive in it, they feed on the style of life that being a restaurant owner or a chef in a restaurant provides, which is you work a lot. With that, I think that I would agree, you know, you have to constantly be reinventing yourself in the restaurant business because it's a third place where, you know, we're entertainment. We are where everybody goes to relax and unwind. And it can be highly competitive. And so you've got to constantly work to stay relevant. You're only as good as the staff that you have. I think there's plenty of people out there with money and plenty of people with ideas, but you know, the differentiator is the people that work inside the business. And it's gotten tough in the last few years. We've opened enough restaurants in this valley that there's now a limit for, and so basically it's Robin Peter to pay Paul. It's just some of the more talented cooks and chefs and service professionals are high in demand, and we battle it out for them.
Guy, what's your take as a sort of a journalist or a critic on the outside, sort of looking in, but one who knows intimately the restaurant industry?
Well, I think as an eater, one of the things that I found here is that we're a conservative food community here, and that has good points, but it has bad points too. And I think we don't often reward innovation in food. And I think when Chris and Ramey and the guys started State and Lemp, one of the big values of that place, I think, was that it kind of broke through that perceived limitation that we all felt about where food could go here in Idaho and in Boise. And I think they showed that there is a real interest for places that kind of push the envelope. And that made me much more optimistic than I'd been in a long time about the kinds of food that people will support here.
We talked about this as a group a little while ago, earlier this morning. Give us some sense and feedback about the diversity in our chefs in the Boise marketplace, those who are kind of local, homegrown, those who maybe have come to us because of Boise's growth and development and its lifestyle and the reason I think most of us probably live here because it's a great place to live. What's your sense about the mix of folks who are doing fun, creative, new things in the Boise market, external versus local kind of homegrown folks?
I guess I can take the first punch. I'm not really a local. I've been accepted into the community, which I very much appreciate. I've been here for 6 years. And, you know, when I got here initially, I knew a lot of the chefs. I met a lot, and they were Boise natives, and I think that that's really great. I do, just from my own perspective, I think that it's important to have people from outside come in because they bring new ideas. Not only that, but a lot of the people that I've spoken to or that are moving in crave something that the larger cities don't have to offer to them, and that is a lifestyle change. Cost of living is really big, but you know, there's a lot of people that started families and things like that, and they're looking for something else. And when that becomes a priority for a chef, I think that that's important because that's a lot of what I've connected with Boise, you know, the community and the culture of Boise itself. You know, so you can take these experiences from larger cities and you can bring that knowledge and still have like a common goal within the restaurants, I think.
Sarah, how has the growth in Boise positively affected your outlook regarding your endeavors, and then what are some of the challenges you see Boise's growth creating for you as a restaurateur?
Positively, like how Guy said, Boise in general is a conservative dining scene. So the growth of people coming in from the outside mixed with some of the people here in Boise, they're a little more adventurous in dining, and I'm not doing anything crazy or new or inventive, but it's not for everyone, and it's usually people who are coming from the outside are willing to give a different style of dining a chance or more of a limited menu a chance. So that's been really positive from people who already live here, but then people coming from the outside to support our different kind of crazy restaurants that we've opened. Also a big challenge is we're getting a lot of people moving for whatever reason. They're moving to Boise, if they're coming to work at a hospital or a startup or a tech, and they're coming from these other cities, and they want good restaurants, and they want to enjoy the nightlife. And for us to keep up and, have these restaurants for all these, the new population to keep, dining at or to supply their demand, it also is hard because a lot of these people who are moving to town aren't restaurant workers. They're other professionals, but they want all the advantages of a cool restaurant scene. If you go to a big city, or I lived in a resort town for 9 years, you're only, the people who live there are, professional restaurant servers, they're cooks, and that's all they're going to do their whole life, that is their career path. And in Boise, you kind of see the restaurant position, unless you're an owner or a manager, it's an in-between job for a lot of people before they get to be what they really want to be. So finding, skilled workers to be able to provide that cool dining scene that Boise has been craving is a big challenge of new people moving in.
Thanks, Sarah. In fact, that's a great segue to one of the audience's questions. This dialogue about a $15 an hour minimum wage. Talk to us about how that'll affect your businesses.
Well, as a small business, I can't afford health insurance and other benefits that a corporate restaurant could. But we already like to pay. The only thing that we can pay right now is the decent wage, because we can't afford those extra benefits. So we always like to try to pay as much as we're able to. If the restaurant's making money, our biggest thing we're going to put money into is paying our staff, because like Dave said, you're only as strong as your weakest employee. So in order to retain that limited talent that's here in Boise, we try to pay well to begin with. But if all of a sudden everybody's paying $15 an hour, no matter what kind of job, then it is a huge challenge for small businesses. But that's what it costs. Like, I'd rather pay a line cook more money than in 3 months from now have to train another line cook. So I'd rather start as high as I can to retain the talent.
As we think about local, I think we're all aware of the fact that we live in an agrarian area, right? And it has become quite popular, almost to the point of being overused, this whole notion of farm to table. How do you view that? What sort of, when you think about local, what does that mean to you? How do you define local? What sort of percentages do you think you can get in terms of local product currently? How might we do things to change that, if in fact you think it needs to change and that's a good direction to go? Guy?
I love the changes that have happened. I grew up in Idaho, and I remember when food here was a very different thing. And I think the local food movement and just America's interest in food has really improved things dramatically. And there are lots of challenges in using local food in restaurants that these guys can tell you about. But I think in general, it's a really positive thing. Dave?
Well, to me, our culinary identity is a critical part of our culture. If I want my 8-year-old to stay here or to go away and eventually want to come back, I think the culture that we have in all regard is going to be the thing that influences him to want to come back and be part of this place in the future. We watched chefs leave this town for many, many years, some chased out, some lured away, because they really weren't supported for the work that they did and the art that they brought to the town. And I think that's starting to change. And part of the reason it's starting to change is because it's gotten really expensive to live in other places. But I think the other thing that's unique about here is we do have this wonderful agriculture area. It's sadly neglected, I think, underappreciated and undervalued. It's at great risk. We continue to expand into it with our neighborhoods and our towns and our cities. We struggle, I think, to build good, sustainable connections between urban and rural, and how we work together, which I think it manifests itself in our politics. We see it in our politics here. And so I think that through our local food system, it's a gateway to build new bridges that could solve a lot of problems. I think to the extent that we can find ways to embrace our agrarian history and our potential agrarian future, you know, I saw a map the other day of what it's going to look like from a climate standpoint in 50 years. And Boise is going to look a lot like Central California. Central California is where a lot of agriculture is happening right now. Mm. So we have assets that could be very valuable in the future if we think about them today and figure out how to protect them. And we do that by figuring out how to support farmers, figuring out how to make farmers' lives viable and sustainable. And it's a complicated problem. Chris?
Yeah, this is coming from a restaurant that served 24 people a night. So, and we got to plan the menu, and the guests were forced to eat what we put out there. So we had a unique situation. For us personally at St. Lemp, and what we've continued to do and what we will do is, you know, working with the local farms is difficult. It costs a little more. It's more time. It's a lot more effort. But it's very important because I genuinely believe that, you know, restaurants and chefs nowadays have a greater responsibility than just putting food out there. You know, we have to educate a little bit, and we have to be part of that. We have to herald the farms because the farmers are working just as hard, if not harder, than we are. And so it's about taking their product and highlighting it. It's about, you know, there's farmers here that we work with. Henry's over there in Global Gardens, you know, and the relationships that we have with them are what we benefit from. We learn a lot about the product, about how it's raised or grown, and you get a lot of inspiration from that. We see different parts of the product. So we, you know, through working with them and talking to them and actually having conversations, we learn that we can use different things at different times of the year, things that they're getting rid of or things that they have too much of that they have problems pushing. We can absorb that and we can help them. So then, you know, then they can focus on something else. And, you know, while that's just the beginning step, it's an important thing to just have that relationship, you know. And on the diner side, we tell that story, you know. And while it may seem cheesy, because I know a lot of restaurants do say they're farm to table, and then, you know, maybe like 10% of it is, I do believe that the diner, they're paying for the experience. And they can feel that, and they can tell that, because, you know, we're putting the work in on it. So the relationship is very important.
So all three of you have resumes with success on them from a restaurant standpoint. And yet all three of you have taken a risk here in recent days, opening Diablo & Sons, Chris, your new endeavor, Sarah with Petit Four. What makes you sort of stop doing something that's really successful and take all this risk and go do something else? Sarah just got really nervous. But talk to us a little bit about, I think that's intriguing for us, for those of us who have been clients who have enjoyed and just loved what you've done. In fact, one of our questions, Sarah, is when are you expanding back into downtown, because we miss you. But why do that? Why take those risks?
There's no struggle. There's no progress. There's so much I want to do creatively. Bluebird, we started it with myself and my husband just on a cook's wage and a bartender's wage. We always wanted to open up our own restaurant. I kind of treat it as a startup. It was a successful startup, but I didn't see myself making turkey sandwiches the rest of my life. I wanted to get back in a full kitchen and be able to be more creative. And in order to make our new venture successful, the reason a big part that Bluebird was successful is we poured everything we had into it, 110% of our time and our efforts, and we really wanted our next venture to be hopefully as successful. And to do that, we needed to focus all of our energy and our skills and our money into what we wanted for our future. So it's very nervous to take that step. And we've just been very fortunate that people have been supportive of us to try out, a new, totally different place than the previous one. But it's just something, a personal goal that I wanted to do from the start. And Bluebird was a good stepping stone to be able to achieve our lifelong dreams. So,
Chris, Dave?
Well, it's a sickness. I know my wife wonders, when are we stopping? What's the plan? And I think that, for many of us, you're either continuing to evolve or, you're fading out. I think the restaurant business is not a static business. The corporate guys, most of them have a lifestyle or a life cycle that is set. They build a formula, they get a bunch of venture capital money, they build this thing, and, they build it to go for 10 years, and that's it. And for us, it's much more personal. It's our life. It's, it's how we exist, and we enjoy it. We're invested in it. And so, from a creative standpoint, and I'm embarrassed to even speak of creative things as I'm sitting here with three of the most creative people in town, and I'm not a creative person. But I think from a creative standpoint, we are always challenging ourselves to do something different and new. And so it's hard to stop. I think each of us have taken different approaches. I've left my leftovers behind, and we keep going with them, which is good. We've been pretty fortunate that way. We've had to sell a few along the road, but we've consolidated now into one building, which is much easier to work from. But yeah, it's really just, I think when you have the bug to do this kind of work and you adapt to the lifestyle and you can exist in the lifestyle, you never stop.
And Chris, let me piggyback on top of that question, a question for you, because you're in the process right now of opening a new restaurant. Help us understand better what that process looks like in terms of the city and permitting. I'm really curious about our new liquor license proposal. Talk to us kind of about the stuff that goes around the business of setting up a restaurant. And then, Guy, I'd like you to maybe speak to some of that as well when Chris is done.
Well, just to touch on the previous question, the liquor aspect is actually part of the reason why we decided to move. We always looked at State and Lip. I wasn't one of the owners of State and Lip. I was just the chef from the beginning. I think no one thought State and Lip was going to make it, myself included. And when we got to a certain point, we realized that we had actually hit the ceiling of that space. We had retained our cooks very well. We didn't pay necessarily well, but they wanted to be around us, and they were excited in what we were doing. And so the reason why we decided to close St. Limp and to move on was because we did want to pay more. We wanted to reward our cooks, and we wanted to give them new responsibilities because of that talent pool issue that we were talking about before. We knew it was important to get them more money, but more than the money, it was the opportunity for them to grow as well. I'm stepping into a new role. They're going to be stepping into a new role, and we're growing. We're going to be called Kim. We're growing as a family. So liquor was a big portion of that, because a tasting menu is difficult to make money in. Despite the higher price point, it's difficult because there's a lot of labor involved. So we needed a little bit of help, and that liquor goes a long way in getting revenue with lower cost of goods and things like that. So as we started to push forward, we ran into the issue of, okay, well, how do you get a liquor license in Idaho, right? Boise specifically. Other cities, they're a little bit cheaper, but Boise right now, market value is about $180,000, and that's without transactional fees and things like that. So for a small business that doesn't have a ton of funding, personal funding, that is a daunting thing to take on. We did find a couple opportunities to lease them, and we actually found two, and now we got to open two bars and deal with that. So that's a problem in itself. As far as city permitting and things like that along the way, it's a little bit tricky because in order to find a space and then have it be, you got to find one that's zoned correctly, but then within that, you have to find one that pretty much was a previous restaurant or bar. Otherwise, you run into the impact fees. And now I understand why the impact fees are there, but it's about $33 a square foot right now. And one building we were looking at was $70,000 of just handing a check over and not seeing anything for that. And when you're talking about an industry where pennies make a difference, $70,000 was part of a deal breaker. So we've been having issues, but a lot of that was our kind of being naive about it and not understanding how it works. So we're learning the process, and we've had a lot of bumps and failures in it, but that's part of it, right? I know Dave was mentioning the struggle of opening a restaurant is kind of legitimizes you to a certain degree. And we are learning a lot, and I'm taking it as a positive so far, but we're not open yet, so who knows?
Guy, how do you see the regulatory scene and all the stuff, if I can use that word, that we put on folks who want to become, who want to enter the restaurant space? Talk to us about that.
I'm probably not as expert at all of that as these guys are because they deal with it every day. But one of the things that I think is an inhibitor, and we've all talked about this before, is it's so hard to take advantage of the local agricultural scene here. There was a distribution company called Idaho's Bounty that went under that was specifically designed to deal with getting local food from farmers and then bringing it to restaurateurs in a way that was efficient. And they've gone under for several reasons, and now we're kind of in this limbo where it's I think pretty difficult, and everybody would say I think the same thing, that although they see the value in local food, and one of the things I think is really valuable about the local food thing, like you say, it's something that's been overused, but it's a way to give a local community something unique. People ask me all the time, how can we put Boise and Idaho on the culinary map? And you do that by providing something that's unique, something that the industrial food system can't provide. And local food is one of the best ways to do that. I mean, the creativity of chefs is really important, but the kind of food that they use is also really important. If it's all coming off the same Sysco truck, no matter what you do to it, it's still going to be kind of the same. And so for me, more than, there are lots of regulatory ways that you can help encourage more local food in restaurants. But I think a lot of it is creating a system that works, and it's been really hard to do that so far.
Fun question. Dave, favorite protein?
Mushrooms. I don't eat a lot of meat.
We'll give you a pass on that.
Mushrooms is the alternative protein.
The ultimate in protein. Chris, favorite vegetable?
It depends on the time of year.
Okay.
But
spring.
Spring. Probably asparagus, just because it always seems like it's a harbinger of the rest of everything else coming in. When you start seeing a lot of asparagus, all the ingredients are about to kick off.
All the good stuff's about to happen. Sarah, favorite dessert?
I'm always a huge chocolate person, but I don't want to promote my own restaurant, but I love sticky toffee pudding. I have a really good sticky toffee pudding on the menu right now. But that has no chocolate in, and it's still probably my favorite dessert.
All right, Guy, favorite style of microbrew?
Oh, God, you're asking me all the wrong questions.
Okay, favorite varietal? as in grape. Like, sorry, that, I went over your head. I've never done that before, guy. It's amazing.
I'm really not qualified for this panel.
I love Sauvignon Blanc. I love all kinds of wines.
Ah, Sauv Blanc. Okay, fair enough. We'll let you off on that one.
Should I just leave?
Nope, not at all. Interesting question when we talk about harking back to some of Sarah's comments regarding the $15 minimum wage and employees and all that kind of stuff. Any of you have a sense whether the expansion of Medicaid will help us retain workers? You have any sense on that, or hasn't hit the radar yet?
Clearly, it would be a good thing. We need to solve that problem. And I think the voters solved it, but we'll see if it's actually solved or not. Yeah. And for us, you know, I'm not sure that a lot of restaurant workers use the system a lot. They're all probably destined to it, the amount some of them smoke and drink, but which is a problem in our industry. It's like sad to me how many we get these, you know, beautiful young people in the doors, and I'm like, walk out in the alley and they're smoking, and I guess I'm old. Why are you smoking? Why are all you people smoking? Why, don't you know this is like, yeah, we knew this years ago. Stop smoking. Anyway.
The food scene in Boise is arguably pretty innovative and pretty successful at the present time. How do you see the ripples of that spreading out across the Boise Valley? And what kind of time frame do you see in terms of that happening? Is that a phenomenon you think is going to happen fairly quickly? Is that a phenomenon you think is going to take some time to mature? What's that look like in your minds? Dave, okay, you want to start?
Let me take this one on. You know, one of the problems with Boise is, and the Treasure Valley, frankly, is that we lack any form of transportation outside of the automobile. We have a bus system that's horribly underfunded and, you know, is not probably the best form of alternative transportation. And how this, I think, impacts us culturally is that, you know, restaurants, as we've talked about, this is a difficult business. And so you insulate your risk by making sure that you pick a location that's going to be a winner. 8th Street seems to be a winner because, man, a restaurant closes and there's one open 15 minutes later. It's because there's the density, the population right there. And I believe a big part of it is because we have so many people living in the North End, East End, and just around downtown that a lot of people can walk and ride their bike. And, you know, even if they drive and they have a couple of drinks, the drive home is, most of them can navigate that short distance. But the further you get from downtown, you take risk. And it's not risk that we want on our roads. So, you know, like I'm living in Europe for a period of time, I went to school there, and it was always, you know, so refreshing to me that you didn't have people drinking and driving. In fact, there, it's against a lot of drink and ride your bike. I got in trouble for that. because culturally, you don't need to, because you can just hop on a train, or, you know, the paths are so well-worn that you can move around. And so in Boise, it limits us. It's great to see Petit Four up on the bench, and they're forging new territory, and they've been really successful. You know, but they're unique. This is a very talented chef, and so it works on personality. How well is the bench going to work? You know, if you don't have Sarah's personality and talent, it's much more risky. And so building these pockets, these neighborhoods where we start to see activity like you see in cities that have transportation systems is going to be a harder sell. It's going to be a hard, and that impacts how the neighborhoods then culturally exist. They tend to not be very interesting. I grew up on Cassia up off of Orchard, and it makes me sad to go up there and see the state of that neighborhood, because when I was a kid, it was a great neighborhood, but it's never lived up to its potential, and mainly because of the transportation system. Now it's just a freeway up there. It's a place to move traffic, and I think we've got to evolve in that way. It's great to see that, you know, downtown Nampa has amazing infrastructure. The Flying M Coffee Garage, I think, has become an institution there, and you know, culturally, our food and beverage facilities are where we get together. It's where we exist. So if you didn't have the Flying M Coffee Garage in downtown Nampa, you wouldn't have, what is it, Pre-Funk, the beer guys. You wouldn't have a lot of those other businesses that are starting to crop up in downtown Nampa. You certainly wouldn't have the new taco place that I can't remember the name of.
Mesa.
Yeah. And I think the same thing in downtown Caldwell. And you know, Marsing is a treasure. But, boy, opening something out there is a lifestyle that is going to be risky. And until we can figure out how to move people around more effectively outside of our automobile, I think we're going to struggle.
Okay, another fun question. One-word answer. Guy, we're starting with you. Which came first, food or wine?
Food, I would hope.
Sarah?
For me, food.
Chris?
Previously it was food, but now it's wine.
Yeah.
Dave?
Oh, definitely food.
Definitely food. All right. Speaking of wine, we obviously live in a valley and in an area that has a robust wine presence. How intentionally do you pursue Idaho vintners when you put your menus together, build your wine lists, that sort of thing? And let me expand that as well to local microbrews, so the craft brewing industry as well. Sarah?
So we want to support as much local breweries and wineries as possible, while at the same time developing our own unique menu. If everybody in town carried all the same local people, there won't be a difference of where you go. So we try to focus on a French wine list, and then we'll do some local wines and Northwest wines. And same with the beer. We try to do some European beers because we want to have this European vibe of our restaurant, but then we will choose some of our favorite local ones and put them on a rotating tap. So it's important to showcase those in our restaurant and support those, while at the same time having your own unique menu that sets you apart from everybody else.
Any other thoughts?
So I guess pairing wines, beers, beverages in general with a tasting menu is kind of a trick because the wine is just as important in the food as the food in some degree because they play off each other. And we would purposefully leave certain aspects out of a dish because we knew the wine was going to bring it. So that said, with local wineries, we do use them as often as possible. One of the problems that we had over time was that a lot of the varietals, a lot of the styles became a little redundant. And a lot of that was because the wineries were saying, well, this is what our consumers want. So they want big reds. Big red wines don't necessarily go with a lot of food, and definitely not the food that we just happened to serve. We needed lighter reds. We needed more acid. We were very white heavy in most of our wine pairings, and people would come in and sort of say, like, where are the big reds, you know? And that was one of those things where we had some complaints about it, but it was another one of those things where people didn't get to choose. So they eventually, you know, it took years to kind of build the trust from the diner that we were saying, you know, this wine is picked specifically for the food. And a lot of times we built dishes based on the wine. And over the past 5 years, the wineries have changed a lot as well. They've evolved a ton. The breweries are great and have been since I've gotten here, but the wineries are really starting to pick it up. And I think a lot of that is the consumer is getting more educated as well. So,
yeah, for us, I mean, we strive to do about 30% in both categories. And, you know the pretentious perspective, I think, is that our breweries and our wineries are still figuring themselves out. It's great that we finally got the infrastructure. I think, you know, viticulture regions take decades to determine what they're really good at. And again, as the climate's changing, ours is changing as well. And so things are changing. It took us a long time to get, just like with restaurants, to get that talent of winemaking. I mean, for the longest time, which wine didn't Greg Koenig make? And now we've got a whole new slew of winemakers, and that's awesome. And it's the same thing with breweries. We've got, you know, a bunch of new breweries in the last 5-6 years, but it tends to be a copycat business. I can't tell you how many times I'm like introduced to somebody that's got the next great pale ale IPA and porter. And oh, by the way, once a year we're making a stout that we're aging in bourbon barrels. I'm like, wow, that's unique. Thank you. We have lots of spots for you. So it's nice to see, you know, Woodland Empire and Barbarian and people who are coming in and doing different things and experimenting. But I think our culture has to evolve. Now, if I take the pretension out of it, we don't evolve unless we embrace those things that come from here. And to me, the more they're doing things that are unique to here, the more interesting I think what they're doing is. I think what we've got going on in our hops industry is interesting. We've got a generational change happening in our hops industry, and this is an amazing hop region. We have probably one of the best microclimates for growing hops in the world, and yet it's been controlled by the big three for decades. The families got one check a year from, you know, one of the big three. Today, that has changed. The older generation, well, they're not dying yet, but they're handing it over to their kids, and their kids have been introduced to craft beer, and they're ripping up these old contracts and starting to figure out what we can do with our hops region that's different than what it used to be. We used to make these giant hops for alpha acids. They were mutants, basically, so that they could inject alpha acids in, you know, at very microscopic levels into macro beer. Now they're trying to develop flavor and aroma, and we need investment in our hop industry because it's got a lot of potential. And part of that investment comes from supporting our local brewers. Even if it's not the greatest, it's important to support them so that they can learn their craft and they can learn how to use the products that come from here. Same thing with, you know, I think the grapes that we're growing here.
I was talking with one of our board members a week or two ago about this forum, and we got on our phones and we sort of did Yelp, you know, top five restaurants. And I realized two of them I hadn't been to, which kind of was a little bit shocking because we like to think we get out and try the new stuff. Having said that, how does social media reviews and that kind of stuff, how does that help or affect your businesses? Sarah, you're smiling. You must want to say something.
Well, that one of your very first questions about the challenges of the restaurant, you know, next to labor and distribution and social media is one of the biggest challenges for restaurants. You know, when I started cooking, there wasn't social media, and you had to, you know, still want to be as good as you can be for your guests to come in, but social media has really put everybody's business on the line for good and for bad. And while I don't go on Yelp, I appreciate all the good comments that are on Yelp, but, you know, that one negative comment, like I can usually pinpoint the exact customer that it was, and it was a difficult situation to begin with. And then they, like, feel, like, well, for instance, like the food writing and journalists used to be considered highly sought after professional career, and now social media has made everybody a food critic. And for good and for bad, I appreciate all the good comments, but at the same time, everybody thinks they're a professional food critic with social media. And it's just crazy because I wouldn't go into a doctor's office or a dentist office and write a review that would ruin their livelihood. And here these small restaurateurs are taking out second mortgages on their houses, pouring everything they have to create this experience for the guest. And while we need to be accountable for our job performance and accept criticism, positive or negative, I feel the social media has kind of blown that out of the water and put everybody's hard work on the line. And I would never try to ruin somebody's career of everything they pour into it by nitpicking it apart for everybody to see.
Interesting. Thanks, Guy. This question I'm going to start with you on. We talked a week or two ago when we were together about diversity and the way in which food kind of informs and educates us from a cultural diversity standpoint and that sort of thing. How do you see the cultural diversity of the food scene in Boise developing. And then, you know, we've got this corridor along Emerald and Orchard that has quite a diverse sort of set of restaurants. Talk to us how you see that kind of affecting what's happening on the culinary scene in Boise.
Well, I think, you know, food reflects culture. And as we get a more diverse culture, we're hopefully getting more diverse food. I think there's a big lag because a lot of the people that are coming from new to Boise and from more diverse backgrounds oftentimes don't have the resources to start restaurants. So you don't see that diversity right away. But it is happening. I grew up on the bench, probably not too far from where you were, and it was not a diverse place when I was growing up. And now, you know, the corridor along Orchard and all of that it's changed dramatically. I still think we have a long way to go. There's a lot more diversity in the population than I think is expressed in the food culture at the moment.
To that point, chefs, how is food with a different ethnic background informing your creative process, your choices in terms of menu items as you build your menus? How does that speak into your development of each of your respective organizations or entities?
So I came from Portland most recently, and one thing that I really saw happening there and across the country and everywhere really is it's a very good thing of restaurants focusing in on certain cultures and really getting good at that. Instead of everyone being French based and trying to cook French food, they're cooking the food that they grew up with, and they're highlighting their teaching, and that's a really good thing. For me personally, I've struggled with it, and I continue to struggle with an identity thing. So I'm Canadian, but I moved from Canada when I was 11, and I moved into Oregon. I did go to a French culinary school. I'm Japanese genetically, but I don't speak Japanese. I've never been to Japan. I did grow up on westernized Japanese food, but that was really my mom having the wrong name for everything. So I don't really know what I was eating back then. And while there's this trend of food becoming focused and celebrating different cultures, I found myself kind of somewhat lost in that because I don't actually know where I fit in. Now, what I've learned over the past maybe 18 months, 2 years, is that I can kind of still draw on that, the diversity of the experiences I've had, and it's unique to itself. I can't necessarily identify it or associate with a lot of people, but I know that, you know, as different cultures and diversity comes in, there's going to be that mishmash of experiences and whatnot. And so it's somehow trying to highlight, you know, that there is authenticity and that's important, but also, you know, it's ever changing. And so obviously I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, thanks. Question here regarding the intentionality within which we pursue local and maybe local and regional, and working within what's available to build and develop off of that sort of mindset. One of the questions that has come up here is, and they may know, but Dave, tell us a little bit about your work with corn and trying to develop some corn that has a artisanal sort of historical place regionally for us, and some of the challenges you face trying to do that.
As we mentioned earlier, it's been an interesting process. I mean, we are making tortillas from scratch, and we wanted to be able to source flour corn locally to be able to make the tortillas. And as it turns out, we grow a lot of corn here, but not a lot of flour corn. And we had really no known history of these corns being grown here. So Casey O'Leary took this on as a project and started growing a bunch of different corns to see which ones would grow well here so that we could get seed stock and send them around. And I think we're into the third year of it. And Henry back there grew some Hopi Blue. And what's interesting is we had identified Hopi Blue as one of the varieties we really liked. As we played around with it, we liked the product that it gave us. But we were learning how to nixtamalize corn and how to grind it ourselves. So it was a It was a tough process. And just as we're ready to turn on the Hopi Blue, the tribe caught wind that we wanted to use this corn and that Casey was growing this corn and became upset. Both the Oneida tribe, which was another corn variety, and the Hopi tribe, because these were legacy corns of the tribes. And it's an idea that we had not considered, that corn, that the seed was, you know, part of their legacy. And, you know, with Monsanto, it's easy to vilify them for patenting corn, but with the tribes, it was much more difficult. And it, you know, caused us all to scratch our head and go, what do we do with that? And so I think Casey's working on that. I mean, obviously, we're hoping to make this a win-win. As Henry told me earlier today, he doesn't think the Hopi Blue is Hopi Blue anymore because it's been grown here. It's different than what they were growing. But these are, you know, these are big questions. But, you know, for us, the deeper part of that is to try to find products. I mean, one of the things we struggle with farmers is the mismatch. And part of it is the lack of system for getting products from the farm to the restaurant, and the mismatch in when farmers grow things and restaurateurs want things, then they come together and the farmer's price is 5x what the restaurant is paying for that as a commodity product. And they're like, I don't know how to sell that at that price. I don't know what to do with it. And these negotiations tend to be awkward at best. The myth of the chef walking to the farmer's market and buying produce at the farmer's market, and that's what they're selling at their restaurant.
You mean everything on Netflix isn't real?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a good story, except it's just not very true. And the reason why is because farmer markets are a retail market. That's where farmers get the highest value. They should be selling their best-looking stuff at the market. I don't want to buy something from a farmer at the farmer's market because I can't afford it, and I want you selling your best stuff. What I want is the tomatoes that don't look so good and, you know, that are, yeah, cracked. Because we're going to do different things with them that's going to make them great. And I need them at a price that's going to work. So let's wait till you're done at the farmer's market. But that system, we've had variations of it over the years, and it's just not come together yet. And we really need it. So for us, the corn project was an interesting one because it's something we're using a lot of. We're going through 50 pounds of corn a day, and so this is you know, economically viable. And we're just one restaurant. If we can get more restaurants to do this, and we're hoping to be able to get the corn online so that we can get to the point where we can teach other restaurants how to do it, making tortillas from scratch is not hard, as it turns out. And they're better. And it's something that we sell a lot of in this town. So that corn, if we could create a variety that is unique to here, that grows well in this climate, could have legs and could be viable for a farmer. So that's the reason behind it.
And I do want to ask all three of our chefs kind of a closing question. And that is, as for those of us in the room who are consumers of what I think is the gift that you give to us in not only a great dining experience, but in a great culinary experience and all that's wrapped up in that in terms of the way it builds relationships, families, friends, gatherings, big and small, we're just a better place. And we're better people because of the good work that you do. How can we help you? What can we do other than the short answer of just come to my restaurant every other night? But what are the sorts of things we can do as people who care about this segment of our city and of our culture and who are here today but also interact with others who are not here today? What are the sorts of things you would tell folks like us to help make Boise's and the Boise Valley actually's culinary scene robust, vibrant, and just continue to grow and innovate?
It's easy for me. I mean, I think just like with local breweries and local wineries, if we want this identity of things that are from here, we have to support them. So I'm not saying to eat at my restaurant. I'm saying to choose the local independent place first. And the reason why is because it is invested in here. It has a chance of, you know, creating more culture that makes the place more interesting. It's like investing in our local architects to take on big projects. It's investing in our local professionals so that they have an opportunity to grow so that we create that culture that's about here, that's unique to here. And especially, I think, supporting those products that from the ground up come from here. So I think as we identify, you know, wineries that are using grapes from here and breweries that are using hops from here and restaurants that are working to source ingredients from here and that transparency is apparent, it's important to support those things.
Thanks, Dave. Chris?
I fully agree with Dave in supporting anything that you can that's local. I think that being open to new experiences and being inquisitive, you know, that's not necessarily saying that you have to take everything that we serve you and say that you like it. But it's about trying it. That's the way that we'll grow, you know, trying new things. I mean, again, I have a 3-year-old, so that's the conversation every day. Well, how do you know if you don't like it, if you don't eat it? I think that this is not necessarily an easy question to answer. I actually was speaking with Jin Yang here in the front. He's a chef from Portland, and we're trying to get him to move out here. So you should talk to him about that. But, you know, he was saying that, and I agree with this. I've spoken with it about it with other people as well. A lot of people see Boise. They say Boise, food-wise, it's a young Portland or a young Seattle. And living and cooking in both those cities, that's kind of true. But it's also not, because Boise is a different place, and it shouldn't be Portland or Seattle. And so it's a matter of, as a city, finding an identity, but definitely within the food industry as well, in restaurants. We don't have to, you know, you can take trends from the other cities, and that's what social media is actually good at, is it's leveled the playing field. But we as restaurants need to band together, and we need to say, we are going to support this, we're going to support this, but we need to have an identity so that Boise can differentiate itself from these other places.
Sarah?
Definitely, I agree to support the independent restaurants. And we need you as customers to be able to survive. And at the same time, we need you as customers to let those independent restaurants be who they want to be and put out this unique food and have it be supportive. You know, everybody always says the customer is always right. Well, while we need your support to be able to keep our doors open, if we let the customer dictate what's on our menu, every place is going to fall into the same category and be the same. The reason why I want to go out to eat somewhere is because I'm not going to make this for myself at home. I'm going to this place because I'm trying something new and different, or something that I can't get at every other place that I go to. So we need to support these independent places, but let them be themselves and at the same time support them. And then another point my husband will appreciate, I tell you this because he takes the reservations, is make a reservation after 6:30, because a lot of these small restaurants, we need to do 2 or 3 turns to stay in business. And Boise's very, they are conservative about dining, and they like to eat between 6:30 and 7, but so does everybody else. And if I go to New York or Seattle, I might be lucky to get a 10 o'clock dinner reservation. And I'm like, oh, that's late. But when I'm leaving at 11:30 or midnight, the restaurant is even fuller than it was when I got there at 10 o'clock. And it's just, obviously, Boise will never be New York, and we don't want Boise to be New York. But we have to widen our notion of eating and grazing and allow it to happen all night long. And so.
Would all of you please join me in thanking Guy, Sarah, Chris, and Dave for their time today?
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. You can connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise. The next forum is on criminal justice reform and Idaho. It'll take place on Friday, March 1st in Boise at the Grove Hotel. You can learn more about that event at cityclubofboise.org.